Committee would come to order, please.
Yeah.
This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is Sunday, May 3rd, approximately 1:35 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time, Representatives Davis, Kelly, myself, Terrio, Hanley, Mulder, and Coring. The first bill I'd like to take up is House Bill 432, dealing with the International Airport Revenue Bonds. And who do we have from the administration that's going to speak?
Oh, we can mark.
Mort, why don't...
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mort Plum, Director of Anchorage International Airport, and I believe we had some people in teleconference that they were trying to connect with that may want to give testimony first so that they could be relieved.
Okay, why don't, we've got Cliff Argue is on. Mr. Argue, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, if you'd go ahead with your testimony, we'll work through the people out on teleconference and then come back to the folks here.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Clifford Argue. I am a staff vice president of properties and facilities for Alaska Airlines. And I also serve as chairman of the Anchorage Fairbanks Airlines Airport Affairs Committee, an organization which is comprised of some 25 airlines which have signed lease and operating agreements with one or both of the international airports. I'm speaking today in favor of House Bill 432, which will authorize the issuance of revenue bonds to fund the much-needed expansion of the domestic terminal at Anchorage International Airport. There are three areas of focus in my testimony, which I would like to cover, and those are the process, the project, and a special interest to this committee, the payments. First, I'd like to discuss the process. Last November, the airlines voted in accordance with agreements each has executed and longstanding past practice to approve the financing and construction of the proposed terminal redevelopment project at Anchorage, with a total estimated cost of $191 million. The vote also approved the Alaska International Airport system to issue airport revenue bonds in an amount necessary to cover the project cost plus financing and escalation, with the understanding that the airport system would continue to use its best effort to obtain alternate sources of funding and financing to reduce airline cost exposure. We hope, but are not certain at this time, there will also be some federal airport improvement program funds available to help in this regard. I believe you probably already have the details of the actual votes and the project, so I will not restate them here. Having been involved for some 30 years in the planning and development of airport terminal facilities, I can tell you that the work to date on the Anchorage project is among the most thorough and professional such efforts I have seen. The needs assessment, conceptual solutions, and financing plans were carefully developed by an expert team of airport staff and consultants. There was excellent coordination with the airlines at every step in the process, as we participated in numerous meetings and reviews. My colleagues from a number of other airlines which serve Anchorage, including Reeve, Linden, Northwest, United, Delta, Reno, America West, Federal Express, and United Parcel Service, all share this feeling on the quality of the process and their support for this project. Just last week, I served on a panel at the annual economic conference of the Airports Council International in San Francisco. This is a trade organization of airports from throughout the world. The session was co-sponsored by the Air Transport Association, which is an association of U.S. domestic scheduled airlines. The conference focused on the topic of airline and airport relationships. While we heard about some very difficult situations around the country, I was pleased that I could point to the Anchorage experience as a model of good cooperation resulting in a project endorsed by the airlines. project, the serious deficiencies in the existing Anchorage domestic terminal are well known, both as documented in the studies I mentioned above and certainly experienced at one time or another by each of you on the committee when traveling through Anchorage or meeting someone who is. The plan to remedy these shortcomings, as well as accommodate forecast growth between now and the year 2005, is sound and conservative. It will provide the citizens of Alaska and the many visitors from outside a modern and efficient and functional airport terminal serving the largest city and air transportation hub of the state. It will also allow passengers flying out of Anchorage to experience and benefit from the newest technologies to speed their progress through the terminal. We at Alaska Airlines are especially excited about these opportunities for the project to allow us to offer better customer service as quickly as possible. Finally, and probably the most important consideration, is the payment. As you consider this legislation, I urge that you give the airport system the maximum flexibility necessary to issue the bonds for the project all at one time and immediately. This is the most cost-effective way to proceed rather than to try to break up the project or phase it. These bonds will be backed by airport revenues generated from rates, fees, and charges imposed on the airlines, concessionaires, and others benefiting from the airport. The proposed bonds in no way will impact the state's general fund, nor will they harm the ability for either Anchorage or Fairbanks airports to continue to develop other necessary improvement projects using already established capital project funding resources. The additional cost to the airlines of this development project in Anchorage, when considered on a cost per in-plane passenger basis, is modest, and the airlines which support the project are ready, ready to make the payments. The airport system proposal is prudent and reasonable, and a good approach to funding much-needed improvements to one of the major economic engines of the state. Members of the committee, this is a project whose time has come. The need is overdue and well-justified. I urge your favorable action on this bill to allow the important work to move ahead in a timely and complete fashion. I appreciate the opportunity to comment, and I'll be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Argue? Seeing none, thank you very much. Let's see. I think we need to hang up Mr. Argue so that we can call the next person. We're not set up to have everybody tied in at once this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Kurt, did you want to make a couple comments while we're dialing in the next
thank
person?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt Parkin, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. We're prepared to give a short presentation if you wish, or we could just take questions as whatever. We have some charts, and Mort Plum, Director of the Airport, is here to talk about the project if you want. Ross Kinney from Department of Revenue can speak to the bonds and the finance. Whatever is your wish.
Okay. Why don't we just touch on the comment that they want the flexibility, they want the bonds all issued at once.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ross Kinney. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue for Treasury Division. What we're looking at in this case is a situation where interest rates are at a 20 to 25 year low. Certainly when you look at bond sales, there are a number of costs that have to be considered over and above what you have to actually pay in the form of interest rates. And those deal with things like rating agency fees. The bonds will be rated by three agencies, so we have three ratings. You look at attorney's fees. You have to have bond counsel opine on the project and approve the documents. There is a printing of an official statement and a number of other things, financial advisors, that actually go into the sale of a bond issue. When you look at breaking it into components, you're going to repeat those costs time and time again. From the airline's perspective, they want to issue these bonds at the least possible cost, so we're looking at a single package in order to do that so that we have one sale and we pay those costs one time and one time only.
Okay, so that savings more than offsets having the big pool of money and paying your interest rate for a longer period of time, or holding money while you're paying on it?
Mr. Chairman, we will be in a situation where we have to do the arbitrage rebate calculations. The interest earnings on the bonds will be limited to the interest rate that's being paid on the bonds. If not, then we'll have to rebate that excess to the federal government. We should be able to recoup those interest payments based on the length of time that we actually hold that money prior to its being expended. Having said that, as you well know, this is a long duration project. It won't be completed for a number of years. And we are prepared to go to the Internal Revenue Service and request a ruling that will allow us that flexibility to hold a portion of the bonds longer than normal. The normal period on that would be a completion date of 3 years or 36 months. And we believe that based on prior history that we will be able to receive a favorable ruling from the IRS.
Okay, what's the total project, the timeline for from start to completion? Representative Grusendorf, could you put your microphone up on the edge? Just that'll help catch discussion.
Take a look where we started back here, Mr. Chairman, with the needs assessment brings us up to this particular point here, and we're before the legislature now. If we go as we have it planned through schematic, we would open up C concourse in November, C replacement in 2001, November of 2001, and then we would pick up the other pieces, and the full project would be complete by 2003. Ponderance of the work, of course, would be with the C replacement, and then the next part would be the renovation of the current A and B terminal area.
Okay. Are there any other questions? If not, we have Ed Merlis online now with the, is it the Alaska?
The Air Transport Association.
Air Transporters Association. If you go ahead with your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Edward Merlis, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs of the Air Transport Association of America. ATA's members are the principal U.S. flag carriers who fly passengers and cargo in the United States. About a dozen of our members serve Alaska, either from the lower 48 or including Revolution within the state, and our members have been deeply involved in the development of the Anchorage Terminal Expansion Program. We believe that this project is a model for airport-airline cooperation throughout the United States. The project is well-sized, it is conservatively priced, and meets the growing needs at Anchorage for the early part of the next century. We think it's particularly important that the committee and the legislature move expeditiously for several reasons. One, as already indicated, interest rates are particularly low, so a good financing plan can be put into effect. Secondly, it takes time to build these projects, and there already is significant congestion in the existing terminal. The sooner we can get on with the project, the sooner it can be completed, and the high level of service which our members want to provide to the traveling public can be accomplished. And thirdly, 1998 is a year in which the Congress of the United States will consider renewal of the Federal Airport Improvement Program. This provides us with an excellent opportunity for obtaining a substantial portion of the cost of the project from the AIT revenues. It would be unfortunate if we were to miss this opportunity in 1998 because the legislation in the state of Alaska has not passed. And of course, if it does pass, we're in that much better position to put our shoulders to the grindstone and try to get the monies necessary for the completion of the Anchorage project with as much federal AIP money as possible. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm free to take any questions you may have. I know some others from the industry will be on who may be able to speak with greater specificity to the exact project, but I just wanted to put our endorsement on it. Our membership is strongly in support of the project.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee members for Mr. Merlis? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Merlis. We do have to sign off with you so that we can dial up the next person.
Certainly, I understand it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, quick question on this one photo here. I can't quite tell because of the glare. You know, it looks bad that you have planes that are deplaning passengers. They can't pull up to the ramps, but I'm not sure if these are the passenger cargo ones that would not be able to pull up to the ramp anyway.
Mr. Chairman, in the summer months, Alaska Airlines is forced to double and triple stack, and certainly some of those may be combis, but the reason that they are double stacked is because that there's no room at the primary gate. So if there's one on the gate, they would still have to pass that one and walk to the second tier or the third tier in the morning go.
Okay, we'll wait and we'll have the last person, Ron. Is it Ron Lane?
Lance.
Actually, while we're waiting, just for the committee members' information, the number that's sort of been batted around is 175 or 180. The number here that's bolded on the bill is 280. If you could just explain that we're adding on to the existing 100 and what that mechanism, overall mechanism is.
Mr. Chairman, in existing statute today, the authorization is for $100,825,000 for airport improvements at both Fairbanks and Anchorage over the past. Those bonds have actually been issued, but the issues are outstanding. This bill simply amends that language to increase the authorization to the prior and the new issues.
Why is it now, is it just, are you never able to back that number back down to towards zero, or?
Chairman, as long as those bonds are outstanding, we still need that authorization to be on the books as security for bondholders.
Are there any other questions from committee members while we're waiting? Why don't we just take a quick at ease while we're getting Mr. Lance dialed up?
George, is that what they told me?
So is this? Okay, we'll go back online. And do we have Ron Lance online? Okay, who is this? Are we tied into the Anchorage Airport now?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
This is Dave Eberly and Don Ketner.
Okay, if you go ahead, please, with your comments.
Mr. Chairman, they are part of our staff available to answer questions.
Okay.
And I believe we also have George King on the line.
Yes, you do.
Who is also available to answer questions if we need them.
Okay. And, did we need to dial on Ron Lance?
I think Mr. Lance is at a separate number. He's with United Airlines, and I think he's
maybe
this.
He's a
little distant. Mike, quick question for you.
We're still at ease, sir. Don, why don't you have somebody go to another line and call?
Well, they can't do it.
Actually, I think this is probably, we did want to just end up having these DOT folks online. I guess, Mr. Lance, we were not going to dial in. So we'll just leave this hook up in case their questions do come up. Okay. Kurt, is there other information that you need to provide us with?
Mr. Chairman, I think that we've provided a lot of material to the previous committees, and I think that should have been delivered to you, if not to make sure you have more. At the very least, we have this gray book, which is a summary of the project, but there's been an extensive planning process, as Mr. Argue mentioned, and we've got a substantial amount of backup information on the project, so it's hard to say what you'd want us to go over at this point.
Well, from, I had an opportunity coming back through Anchorage one morning, ended up being with my young son, who was fascinated with all the planes in Mr. Plum's office, plane models, but was able to go down into the basement section, take the full tour. So up to that point, I was somewhat unconvinced in the fact that my visit was completely unannounced, and, I saw the visqueen hanging from the ceiling and the trash pails to catch the water. I felt assured that it wasn't a presentation for my benefit. So, because of that time that I was able to spend that morning, I don't have a whole lot of questions myself. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mort, perhaps you could take just a couple minutes to walk through. When we also had the benefit in IT&T, Mr. Chairman, of having about a dozen or more hours of testimony on this bill, so it's not a whole lot of new to me. But at the same time, for the benefit of the committee, Mort, perhaps you could talk about, there were some assertions made previously that this was just a concept. And I think that we really refute, or we came to understand that that's not true, that this is something that's been in the works for a while. But if you could walk through the planning process and also how the numbers were derived and the relative comfort margin within those numbers in terms of if there are problems, if there is a slowdown or an increase, how that's factored into the overall model.
Representative Mulder, this process probably started around November 1995 when we met and realized that the current sea terminal was extremely deficient. At that particular time, we started a small group inside the airport to take a look and assess what we thought were some of the critical areas. We completed that assessment. We presented our assessment to the airlines, and I believe it was around November 1995. And we requested permission to proceed to take down C Concourse.
Excuse me, Ron Lance is online. Thank you.
Shortly after that, we started a needs assessment. Included in that process, first of all, was to take a look at the current facilities we had. One of the proposals was to take a look at the North Terminal. At first glance, it was an excellent question. Why don't we use the North Terminal? I think after a closer inspection, when we realized that terminal was built for basically the benefit of duty-free, if you will, a shopping mall for 8 gates, the internal piece of that in the lower level was built for customs and immigrations. When we took a look at trying to modify that, we realized that would probably not be cost-effective. In addition, some of the forecasts that had been done for us by the Lee Fisher master planning people indicated that in 1995 they did not foresee an increase in international traffic greater than 362,000 by the year 2012. In fact, last year we put over 700,000 people through that facility. In addition to that, we have included up to 50 to 70 international flights a week there. And in the summer, we have a multitude of domestic charters as well as the return of some of the international charters. So after close scrutiny and analysis, it was determined that the international terminal was not a viable option. That drove us back to the current domestic terminal, which is A, B, and C Concourse. Realizing that C Concourse was not going to meet the needs, and realizing that without C Concourse, we only have 75% of the room that is needed to fulfill the passenger needs today. That is an overall amalgamation of statistics. When you look at some of the more critical areas, such as bag claim and ticketing area, they are well under the 50% mark. We took a look at what our passenger growth was through 1997, and that averaged basically over 4%. The 1997 figures, in fact, were somewhat over 5%. The 1998 figures are somewhat flat. As we realized, in any statistical analysis, you're going to have a sawtooth. Some are going to have greater increases, and some will be a little less. Anyway, we felt fairly comfortable in using 3.6 to 4.2% as our forecast to determine what our needs would be for the future. So, basing the deficiencies of 75% in the amalgamation, 40% in some of the critical areas, and the modest increase in traffic, we sort of set out our model for the future. One of the things that we determined to be important was to look out past the immediate years. We have been burdened by piecemeal efforts in trying to plan an airport planning, and this is just not very cost effective. We brought a design team in to look out to the year 2015. In fact, we estimated our passenger traffic would be approximately 10 million people by 2015. Realizing we probably didn't want to build all the way out to that year, we tried to make an assessment of where it would be reasonable to build to take care of the deficiencies we had and accommodate the modest increase. We made that cut at the year 2005. We went back and asked our people to design a facility that would accommodate the traffic for 2005. So we looked at the current deficiencies, we looked at the modest increase in traffic, did a needs assessment, and came up with a phased approach that we would build to 2005 and then programmatically hit the other pieces as the forecast numbers were reached.
The other point I thought was important, what's been your experience that you at least have looked at in terms of expansion like this being supported by the carriers in other locations? I mean, has it been as cooperative as it's been here?
Representative Mulder, we, in talking with my peers at other airports, we are blessed with a phenomenon that not too many of them have. Usually the airlines are fairly critical of expansion projects at airports. There are some airlines that just as a matter of fact sort of say we'll only give you 75% of what you need. So I think that in the industry we are known as the process second to none. And the fact that we partnered with the airlines from the very beginning, certainly when you have a lot of different interests, you have cargo carriers, international and passenger, you got domestic passenger and cargo, and you got regional passenger and cargo, it's very difficult to come up with something that everyone wants to support completely. But we worked in a partnership with the airline. We went through the process, had over 8 technical committee meetings with them, and, of course, they voted on the project.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, the planning process developed, I think there were 13 different conceptual designs. And working with the airlines came up with a 14th that was the ultimate design concept that was developed. So clearly they've been at the table and integral parts of this since the beginning.
The other concern that I had first, Mr. Chairman, when we looked at it was my concern that seeing that this was going to be built for the year 2005, but it was going to be bonded for a much longer period of time, what would happen in 2005 if we still had the full indebtedness, but we had, you know, we had needs to for further expansion? But what was built into the factor or the equation to pay for the bonds was, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Plum, but I believe right now we have very modest landing fees. There would be a slight elevation of landing fees over about a 5 or 7 year or 10 year period, and they'll come back down again. So there will be the possibility for expanded bonding capacity in the future at the time that we're going to need to reconsider whether we need to grow again. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, you're absolutely correct. In fact, the model we used 72 cents. It goes up to a high year in the year 2002 of 93 cents, and it comes back to a blend of somewhere around 79 cents over the life of the project. And in the packets, and I have available here also comparisons between landing fees at other airports, but as an example, using the 72 cents at Anchorage International, Seattle is $1.35. Spokane's $1.06, Oakland is 91, and these are an apples-to-apples comparison. And also in information that's available, we have total cost for operating several different types of aircraft at Anchorage compared to other airports. We compare favorably.
Thank you. I do believe we have Ron Lance online now. Mr. Lance, are you tied in?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, would you like to go ahead with your comments, please? And you're with
you're
with United Airlines?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ron Lance. I'm the general manager for United Airlines in Anchorage. At the beginning of 1997, United had 45 employees in Alaska. We now have a total of 225 employees living mostly in the Anchorage area. This represents a significant investment in the Alaskan economy, as well as our confidence in the state to support our growth. Our present operations are approximately 25% passenger-related and 75% cargo-related. It is our intent to expand our cargo operations in the near future. The present facilities are inadequate to support further expansion in both areas and needs to be corrected. From United's perspective, it would have been helpful if the proposed Anchorage International Airport expansion plan, which this bill before you today supports, had been passed 3 years ago with the facilities coming online now. Others will testify about the need for facilities. There's no question about this need from United's point of view. The facility at this point simply does not fit the size of the passenger and cargo traffic going through Anchorage International Airport. It is important to stress the fairness of the process by which the expansion plans were decided. United is an employee-owned airline which, as a policy matter, attempts to move decisions down to the lowest possible level. That same type of policy was followed here. All of the airlines that were involved had a chance to participate in the decision-making process. The Airport Affairs Technical Committee reviewed the plans and reduced them from as many as 15 concepts down to one. There was a lot of give and take during that process and more give and take to come up with the final plan. In short, everyone had a say and a compromise solution was reached by the airlines that will ultimately pay for the project. This bill needs to move this year. Financial markets could not be better for the type of proposal we're making. More delay will result in more triple parking around gates and problems for passengers and cargo customers as well. United strongly urges that the committee move this bill as soon as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be prepared to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Lance? Okay, seeing none, do the committee members have questions for any of the DOT personnel? Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Plum, I think looking at the drawing, you're going to tie in the international terminal or whatever you're calling it. I don't know what term you use for it. Then will that be used for domestic when that's tied in, or will it still be a international?
Representative Davis, in the interim, we have moved Delta Airlines over there, and it's really a tight fit, and it is our current proposal to move Delta back out of the international terminal after we get the C replacement.
So then the long-term future, yeah, of that, it will be, your plan would be to keep it strictly international?
That's correct, yes. The north terminal, sits up here, will remain primarily used for international traffic. Again, because in the summer sometimes we will probably have to use that as an overflow for domestic charters as well as international charters. But the primary use will be international traffic. And in the morning hours, it is full today. Between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m., it's when the heavy time is there.
Further questions?
No wonder I haven't seen it used.
Kurt, is there any other DOT personnel that you need to have come forward? Okay. If we'll just take a quick at ease. Representative Hanley just had to go meet up. Okay, if the committee will come back to order. Are there any further questions on House Bill 432? Seeing none, Representative Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass CS for House Bill 432, International Tourism and Trade, from House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill will move from committee.
You're doing the...
Good job, Joe.
Gary,
didn't
I do a good job?
Gee, you convinced me, man.
It's brought the big guns with you, huh? No, we're just going to...
No, how y'all doing?
I just asked.
Good.
Good year?
I'm ready for something.
I'm thinking my book. You guys have any...
We'll
see you all.
If the committee would come back to order, the next item we have up is House Bill 344. And what I would like to do today is just basically get the testimony of what's being proposed here, why it's being proposed, and just really get a better understanding of what is required. It's my understanding by the federal government changes, federal legislative changes. And it's not the intent to move this bill today. So with that, Barbara, are you the lead person?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Michalis, and I'm the Director for Child Support Enforcement. House Bill 344 was introduced to comply with welfare reform requirements established by Congress. In 1996, Congress passed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, and this act ended welfare as we knew it. But in order to make people, one of the objectives was to get people off of welfare and make them more self-sufficient, and Congress realized at that time that one of the tools that they needed to do this was to enhance child support. And so along with the many requirements that they made with welfare, they put on many requirements for child support. So we have introduced this bill to comply with those requirements. Many of the legislative changes that were required by welfare reform were passed last year in Senate Bill 154. Since that time, there have been some technical amendments to the welfare reform legislation which have required more changes. So that's some of the things that are included in this bill. Plus, there were some changes that were not incorporated in last year's bill because at that time the legislature realized we had one more year in which to pass these. So this bill hopefully takes care of everything that's required in welfare reform. The federal government has told us that if Alaska does not comply with the welfare reform requirements, that we would lose all the federal money that goes into child support, which is the primary source of funding in our budget, and ultimately we would lose the public assistance block grants. So it's a total of approximately $78 million. So it's a very important piece of legislation. It's the reason that we had the legislation introduced is because it was necessary.
Certainly we always hear of those federal threats, and usually we comply and don't know if the federal government would really carry through. Was there language in the Personal Responsibility Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act that made it real clear that all of the things had to be followed through on, or else those funds were gone?
Yes, there is. This is Dan Branch from the Department of Law, and Dan is the expert on both the welfare reform legislation and as well as our legislation. There is requirements there to do that, and if you wanted a specific site, I know Dan would be able to give that.
Okay. I would like to see that, you know, if it's specifically spelled out that way. And also, is there anything contained in the judiciary draft that is not absolutely required by federal law? And if so, if you would highlight those things.
Okay. First of all, one of the things that I know that's in your packet regarding the federal requirements is a letter that is dated, got a fax date on it of June 15th, and it's a letter from the regional administrator from the federal government. His name is Steve Hennigsen. And in that, Steve Hennigsen talks about the requirements to make these changes, and that if you fail to make the changes, the money that will be lost to Alaska. So I think you all have a copy of that letter. And the second part of your question is, yes, there were some things. When we were in Senate Hess, we started talking to, or at least Senator Wilkins' office started talking to the National Council of State Legislators, and we found a couple things that were in the bill that we all agreed didn't need to be in the bill. And maybe Dan could address those specifically.
Okay, Representative Kelly, question.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the letter from Steve Hennigsen.
It was in the paper-clipped pack with all the fiscal notes. It's about halfway through the packet.
And what was the amount that we're at risk here?
All of the money that goes to child support, which is approximately $15 million, and all the money that's in the public assistance black grant, which is about $63
million. Okay.
Colin, could you get me?
It's a letter to...
Oh, there it is. I've got it. I have it.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, so over... On the Senate side, they identified portions in, you said, Senate Hess,
mm-hmm.
and removed those from the bill when they reported it out?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, if you could just maybe walk us through, point out those sections, specific sections, so that we can...
Well, I can show you. The first section would be in the committee substitute for House Bill 344, Judiciary. It would be Section 4.
Okay, and would you like to explain that section and if it's not needed or required by the federal government, why the administration had that rolled into the package?
One of the things that welfare reform requires is that each state has some sort of sanction that allows you to withhold a hunting and fishing license for non-support. And the way we've chosen to approach that in our legislation is that it would only be in cases of criminal non-support or people who are in contempt of court. And at one time, it's Section 5. Our original interpretation was it was also that if someone aided the non-payment of child support, then that person would also be lose their hunting and fishing license, and we learned that that was not necessary. And the federal government confirmed that that was not required as far as Perora was concerned.
Well, what I've asked Barbara to do is just highlight those sections that are not required by the...
I'm trying to... Do you know the next one, Dan?
Well, there's also Section 2.
Oh, I need to mention, yes, there were a couple amendments that have been made in the bill's travels through the House. Section 2, for instance, is an amendment that was made by Representative Porter, and so that is really technically not required by the welfare reform legislation.
Okay, is that, does it deal with this general section or the topic that we're discussing, or did Representative Porter put that in because this was a convenient vehicle for something?
It's my understanding it was the second. He had a request from a constituent, and we didn't object to the amendment, so he put it in the bill.
And that was Section 2.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section judiciary version, Section 5 and Section 6 are connected, aren't they?
Right.
So were they both taken out?
Part of it, and I'm not sure, Dan, was all of Section 6 taken out, or is it part of Section 6?
Section 5 refers to Section 6.
Yeah, I think at least part of it was taken out. I just didn't know if all of it was.
I would think on page 2, line 27, when you have criminal non-support or aiding, the portion or aiding, which is linked up to the offense up in Section 5, would have to come out.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that, my name is Dan Branch. I'm with the Department of Law here in Juneau. And... specifically, the difference between the Senate version and the House version of this bill in this area is that the Senate version does not allow a person to be punished for failing to honor a child support subpoena or a paternity warrant by having their recreational license taken away from them if they're not a child support debtor. Okay, so it is true, as Representative Davis points out, that... In the Committee Substitute and Resources for 252 does have a section which amends 1255-139. It does so to create an additional penalty for failure to pay your child support, whereas in the House version, a person would receive that same penalty if they failed to honor a child support subpoena or warrant. We learned through the process and dealing with the federal government that they were reading this a little differently than we had when we drafted the governor's bill. And because we were directed both by the executive branch and we realized that the House and Senate wanted to have just what was required by the federal law, we went along with the changes that are shown in the House, in the Senate version.
And so part of Section 6 has changed?
Yes, right. Section 6 has changed by taking away reference on line 27, page 2 now, line 27 and 28, to or aiding the non-payment of child support under AS 1155-122.
Okay, so we're up to sections 5 and 6, or other sections.
Okay, the next section that I have that wasn't originally required by the federal legislation is section 11. And this was an amendment by Representative Roekberg in House Judiciary, and it would allow the Vital Statistics Bureau to be able to give marriage information to child support, because right now under law they're not allowed to do that. So he added this amendment to this bill.
And so that is designed to what? Just track a person?
Right. And we have in some of our support orders there's inclusions for spousal support. If there's a child support order, some of them have spousal support orders. And so and the spousal support often ends when the other spouse gets married, but child support had no way of officially knowing that because the Bureau of Vital Statistics is prohibited by law to give out that information to us. So this would enable them to give that information to us, to child support, in those cases, marriage information.
Okay. And was that a section that the Senate had proposed being dropped, or?
No, the Senate hasn't seen that section at all. This was Section 2 and Section 11 are solely in the House.
Okay, next.
Section 12 is a change, and I think that also there's a couple other changes. One of the things we realized as we were going through this legislation, some of the requirements that the federal government has imposed on child support have to do with Social Security numbers being included in various applications. And last year, in Senate Bill 154, there were requirements that Social Security numbers be kept on certain court papers, like divorce and dissolution papers. Well, then, as we're sort of researching the fact and trying to make sure that these numbers are kept as private as possible, we realized that those are documents that are open to the public, which is a violation of the federal law. So the court system and the administration got together to protect those Social Security numbers. So there's some amendments introduced by the court system and some amendments introduced by the administration that would take the numbers off the court papers, allow the court to keep a separate document that has Social Security numbers on it, and then allow the court to give that information to CSED. So it was a further protection of Social Security numbers. One of those sections is Section 12.
Okay. So I thought the language that we adopted last year, specifically with regards to Social Security numbers, was required by federal law. And that what we had done, I thought, was required. But you're saying it just allowed the information to be more available than,
right,
than was necessary.
Right. And in fact, this information is required, and it must be transmitted. But what we've done is we've taken it off the public documents, so it would not be available for anybody to look at. And I think that was just an inadvertent error, and so now we've made it stronger this year.
Okay, so required that the information was available to the state agency.
Right, only. So Section 12 is one of those amendments, and also Section 15 is. And Section 16 is also a court amendment. As you can see at the very end on page 6, they've taken off Section 12 that has the Social Security numbers included on the documents.
I'm sorry, which one are you on now? 16?
16.
Pardon?
I didn't get that last reference.
Oh, okay. Dan just informed me that 13 is also one of these sections. And what was the other number?
16.
So it would be 12, 13, 15, and 16. Is that correct?
And 17.
Okay. And what about 18? And 18. Sorry. Did you get all those?
12, 13, 15, 16, 17, and 18.
Correct.
All fall into the category of not a new requirement by federal law, going back to the action last year so the information is available to the system,
right,
but not to the general public.
Exactly. Okay. I think the next amendment, pretty much all of this was in the original bill and pretty much as it is in the Senate, although the Senate made some minor changes. What about Section 28? Is that the next one, Dan?
Section 28 is in the Senate version. Let me just have a check.
Okay.
Because of the foreign.
Well, what were the ones that were taken out with the definitely Section 40. Okay, Dan is checking on Section 28. Okay, it is. The next one is Section 33, and this was part of Representative Roetsberg's amendment. And again, it has to do with vital statistics releasing the information to child support enforcement. And then is Section 40 the last one?
Right.
Section 40 was removed, and that was one of the sections that was removed when the National Council on State Legislators reviewed the bill.
40.
And 41.
So NCSL reviewed the bill and recommended that those sections were not required?
They indicated that they didn't believe that they were required, and so we researched it and agreed with them and took them out. So it was based on kind of half of their indicating that they thought there were some things in there that weren't necessary, and then we looked into it and agreed.
Okay. And back to, just from my own notes here, scribbling on the bill, Section 28, did it fall into this category or not?
No, it did not. It is still in the bill and is necessary.
Okay, are there questions from the committee members? Thank you. We do have also Ron Creature.
Chairman, you're holding this bill over, correct?
Yes, it's my intent today. I just wanted to sort of go through, find out what was truly required, the steps that were required by the federal government, and those that were not. The Senate, over the Senate side, things are in, things are out. We don't have to follow everything they do. I did want to identify those things that were dropped out on that side because they weren't mandated by federal law. So, Mr. Creer?
Chairman Theriault, for the record, my name is Ron Creer. I'm Special Assistant to the Director of Public Assistance. I am here to encourage the committee to consider passing this legislation. Conforming legislation, as Director Miklos indicated, is necessary to avoid jeopardizing the state's TANF block grant. We have received every indication from the administration of children and families that without conforming legislation, we will be penalized. And we'll lose when we submit our next state plan, the $63 million in our TANF block grant, if the conforming legislation isn't there. As a condition of receipt of the TANF block grant, we have to be able to confirm when we submit our next state plan next year about this time that the child support plan conforms to federal legislation. Even if that risk wasn't there, we would be here encouraging you to support child support enforcement legislation that enables the state to actively and in some cases aggressively pursue child support because it is so essential for promoting the self-sufficiency of families on welfare. Without that additional assistance, it just makes it that much more difficult for poor families, single parents, to achieve self-sufficiency. I'm happy to respond to any questions.
Okay, Mr. Creer, either for you or for Barbara. Now, let's go back through and those sections that are absolutely mandated by the federal government. If you want to just make a quick comment on what new mechanism or what we're proposing, and please don't dwell on them all, but if you want to just go through and say, this is what we're doing, and this
is why. Well, sort of, I could do a summary, or do you want me to do it section by section, which is your preference?
Summary would be fine, actually. And if you just say, you know, section 4 or 5, this is the idea being proposed.
One of the major provisions of the bill is that the bill requires that all employers report all new hires and rehires to child support within 20 days. And that is something that we believe and has already been shown to be very effective in many states. And that is section, that was an easy one to find because it's a big section, section 25. And that section we have verbatim from the federal legislation. The give the courts authority to revoke sport fishing and hunting licenses in some criminal cases if the license holder is substantially in arrears on child support. Those are generally the first sections, excluding section 2 and the ones that we've talked about that weren't necessary, but section 3, section 4, section 5, those are the hunting and fishing license sections generally. Mandates that Social Security numbers be provided for child support purposes on applications for driver's licenses and hunting and sports fishing licenses. And that sort, those are sort of interdispersed or dispersed throughout the bill. But what it does is it requires that it would be on the application but not necessarily on the document that's given to the public, and that information be available to child support. It gives child support liens from other states the same standing as Alaskan liens and provides that a liens arise as a matter of fact of law. And let's see, I don't know which section that is. Do you know off the top of your head?
Section 29 through 31.
Okay. 29 through 31. The rest of the changes are pretty much technical changes. I think that those are the biggest, have the most impact on the citizens of the state of Alaska. But some of the other changes are give the courts authority to hold a person in contempt for failing to honor a child support subpoena, amending the definition of a support order, allowing the entry of default judgments in paternity cases, permits child support agencies of other states to make electronic requests for high-volume enforcement assistance to the Alaska CSCD, clarifies which state's law an employer must follow when served with an interstate income withholding order, provides a method for Alaska's child support agency to help a child support obligor's children to receive health coverage when they change their job, improve income withholding provisions, and then repeals the sunset provisions of last year's Senate Bill 154. Last year, Senate Bill 154 had the legislation sunset in 1999. And I think it's the last section here, well, section 39, that repeals that sunset provision.
Okay, and what was the date on that sunset?
1999.
January?
I can't remember. Do you know, Dan?
June.
July 1st, 1999.
Okay, so it wasn't. It wasn't until after the next legislative session.
What does it move that? What does it move that sunset to?
It removes it completely.
Yes, it removes it completely.
Are there other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Attorney Davis?
So there are a number of sections in here that require the courts to give CSCD Social Security numbers when asked. And
yes.
So that seems pretty important. Is a Social Security number ID, is that your key? That's what you work for as far as keeping track of these people. That's your key ID?
Yes, exactly. That's
operation.
The reason for it.
Okay.
And that has been concern for some people, but we are responsible for holding that private. And the federal law says that that must be private information.
Okay. It appears by the requirements of the feds that they feel that fishing and hunting license seem to be more important than Social Security numbers.
So in all of that language, though, that's not, it's language that's in this bill that's not required by federal law, but it's a clarification of the bill, on the bill that we passed last year. Requiring,
well, the fact that it has to be available is required, but it didn't have to be available on the divorce papers themselves. So we've made it that, yes, it does have to be available, but we have a more confidential mechanism for the court to keep those numbers.
Okay. Are there any further questions? I think what we'll probably do is just have a CS prepared that drops out those things that were not required. The Social Security language, where we're talking about an alternative document where the information is available to the department but not the general public, probably consider leaving those all in. Representative Kelly?
Just a quick discussion on whether or not to drop out the provisions about releasing whether the person has remarried or not. Is there a reason that isn't something we want to
put in there? Actually, I noted those ones. I want to speak to Representative Porter and Representative Goldberg. The marriage one, actually, that does strike me as something probably is sensible to do. Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll notice the bill for come back before the committee sometime probably in the early part of the week. Has to be in the early part of the week.
The latter part of the week really is pulling down.
Are adjourned.